You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fred's Bird Feeder Show. No, the Center for Auto Safety podcast. I started off that way because Fred said he does not watch his bird feeder while he's recording this show. This week, let's start off with, we're going to start off with NHTSA and NCAP because this is the final days of both of those things. NHTSA updated their 5-star crash test ratings. They will add 4 new technologies, including pedestrian automatic emergency braking, lane keeping assist, blind spot warning, and intervention if a driver tries to move toward a vehicle in a blind spot. Wow, that was hard for me. I don't know why. The new rules also strengthen test procedures and performance standards for technology that's already included in the ratings, such as automatic emergency braking. I love this. This is great. These are all things we've talked about and said, yes, this needs to be part of there, because we've talked about the 5-star test rating being basically everyone gets 5 stars. So, Michael, are you happy with this?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy here with a lot of what's being done in this notice. NHTSA essentially, this isn't a traditional NHTSA regulation. NCAP operates kind of outside of the NHTSA regulatory structure and the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard. So what they're doing here is essentially creating a program to evaluate the crash avoidance systems that are becoming a lot more common on all of our vehicles. There's a very large focus in the update that on automatic emergency braking technology, essentially creating NCAP tests that are that test vehicles' ability not only to meet the current or the federal safety standard that's coming into effect in 2029 on automatic emergency braking, but also, you know, adding, you know, a few miles per hour to challenge vehicle manufacturers to meet that standard, which is great, and that's what NCAP is supposed to do. Also, as part of this, they've, you know, up until now, NCAP has really only given manufacturers credit for having an automatic emergency braking system in the vehicle, that kind of thing. You know, it's based on whether or not you had the technology. The new structure of NCAP is actually going to allow the agency to test and rank those technologies depending on how well they work, so that manufacturers who are doing better on automatic emergency braking are doing better at preventing pedestrian collisions via automatic emergency braking get more credit. And ideally, you know, this is kind of a sliding scale, so that as manufacturers get better, NHTSA comes in and then makes another update to raise the bar, so that the technology, you know, ultimately gets better over time with manufacturers who are seeking a perfect, you know, 5-star rating.
So this only applies to vehicles weighing 10,000 pounds and less. Now, will our Hummer EV be required to follow this?
Well, none. I doubt Hummer EVs or Cybertrucks or any of the vehicles that are not mass produced, you know, any vehicle that has a sales or distribution, you know, 20,000, 25,000 vehicles per year, it's probably not going to qualify for the program, simply because NHTSA can't afford to test every vehicle on the road, especially the ones that just, there aren't that many of them out there. It doesn't matter. So but ultimately this is going to be a great thing, I think, especially if you look at the roadmap. Part of the infrastructure law in 2021 came out that, you know, told NHTSA, you know, we need to update NCAP. Also said, you know, you need to give us a roadmap for what NCAP is going to be doing in the future. that's, you know, essentially so that consumers have an idea of what's going to be protecting the future, but also importantly to give industry a notice of, you know, what they can expect going forward and how safe their vehicles are going to have to be to get a 5-star rating. And the, you know, beyond what's covered in this immediate update to NCAP, which is mostly automatic emergency braking, pedestrian automatic emergency braking, some lane keeping and blind spot intervention features. We're long term, they're going to do a lot of work on dummies. It looks like they're going to be putting female 5% dummies into driver and rear positions in crashes. That's something we've discussed a lot on this podcast, kind of the inequities and in the types of crash test dummies that are used right now. They're mostly male in the front seat positions. And also, you know, there's a lot of other long-term things that are going to take place in NCAP. A lot of focus on new headlights. You know, there's going to be automatic emergency braking at some point that is focused on intersection crash scenarios. Looks like they're trying to get rules out on that, or not rules, but a NCAP test out on that by 2028. There's enhanced automatic emergency braking, which would work at higher speeds and in different scenarios than it does now. And even driver monitoring systems they're planning to start evaluating around 2030. So it's an interesting look at where NCAP could be in a few years. All that is contingent, of course, on how well the next administration supports NCAP.
Michael, for the benefit of those legions of new listeners sitting in the Piggly Wiggly parking lot listening to this podcast, would you please explain what NCAP is and how this is related to harmonization of world standards?
So NCAP is the New Car Assessment Program. It's basically a program where NHTSA buys vehicles. They do a blind buy of the vehicles from dealers, so that manufacturers, you know, can't produce the perfect car for them to test and can't game the system. They take those vehicles and run them through a number of different scenarios and crash tests. You know, you have a crash worthiness ratings that vehicles are given. They do, you know, frontal collisions, rear collisions, and side collisions and offset collisions and all sorts of things to come up with a crash worthiness rating. And now we have, you know, crash avoidance technology that's coming into play in the ratings with automatic emergency braking and some of these other features that are included in the most recent update. And essentially what NCAP does is it creates, you know, a competitive arena where manufacturers compete against each other to achieve the highest ratings, the 5-star ratings that they can then turn around and use to advertise the safety of their vehicles. So it incentivizes manufacturers to continuously improve safety in their vehicles. There are in NCAP, as far as harmonization, you know, we often talk about how the European standards are much higher than the ones than the federal motor vehicle safety standards in America. And NCAP is one way, you know, when the government is not moving fast enough to put in federal motor vehicle safety standards through rulemaking, NCAP can be a little more flexible and they can get new tests and more advanced tests into NCAP that can incentivize manufacturers to make safety advances even when there's not a federal regulation requiring those advances, or that regulation might be years away. So it's a good way of incentivizing safety across the marketplace.
So if a manufacturer opposes this expansion of NCAP, aren't they shooting themselves in the foot with regard to export markets?
They could be. I mean, there is, you know, there is some, you know, NCAP isn't based on the European standard or the standards of other markets. It can, you know, I think manufacturers ultimately would love a system where NCAP is the same all over the world, so that then they only have to build, you know, they want a predictable marketplace. They would love for all the vehicle safety standards in the universe to be the same, so that they only have to build one car that they can then ship to every country. Unfortunately, it's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, federal motor vehicle safety standards move along very slowly. The process is a little more cumbersome than it is in Europe and in Asia and some spots where they can get these standards and certification standards passed a lot quicker than we're able to here. And we've seen the effects of that in the crash data, where the likelihood of a fatality if you're riding in a car in the United States is, 3 to 4 times higher than it is if you're in France. So it's a NCAP kind of is a way that you can incentivize American vehicles to meet these higher standards that you might see in other countries, even if the law doesn't require it yet here.
Oh, thank you for that.
So, NHTSA is putting these new rules in place now, and I don't know if you guys are aware, but in a couple months, a whole new administration's coming into the U.S. government, and that means
hasn't Vin Diesel been nominated for head of NHTSA?
I think he's going to be in charge of the Energy Department. I mean, with a name like Diesel, it's got to be. Anyway, so a new administration comes in, including a new head of the Department of Transportation, which oversees NHTSA. What's going to stop, the reality star who's nominated for the Department of Transportation to say, hey, I don't like this, especially because the person that Trump nominated, Duffy, oh my God, Duffy, will make part of DOT oversees airlines and whatnot. And part of what Trump said is, hey, he'll make our skies safe again by eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And I just think to the NCAP model where, hey, we're putting in the 5% female model, that seems like we don't need that kind of diversity in our crash tests anymore. So what's going to stop these guys from just coming in and saying, yeah, we don't need any of this stuff you guys proposed?
Well, you have to appreciate the undisputed observation that virtually every airline crash that's occurred has been at the hands of a Caucasian pilot. There's got to be some way of improving the complexion of pilots that will help avoid this problem.
The thing about NCAP is that it's supported by the manufacturers as well, especially the ones who do well in it, right? They have a pretty powerful extra selling point when they can say, we're safer than everybody else. So that's the one thing I think I hold out hope for in this process. The NHTSA administrator has a great deal of control over the future of NCAP. However, manufacturers, it's one area where manufacturers I think are somewhat less likely to be a cohesive group pushing against NHTSA action when some of them stand to benefit from NCAP. If you already have great automatic emergency braking, lane keeping, and blind spot intervention technology in your vehicles, you don't want NCAP to go away because you're going to be getting great advertising bullet points to sell your vehicles for the next few years. So NCAP has been around since late 1970s. So it's a very long-standing program under the department that, multiple administrations of all sorts have kept plowing ahead with. And it's, ultimately it's critical, I think, to incentivize manufacturers to keep up with the rest of the world versus the United States falling behind. So there's a competitive aspect to it that I think might help preserve it, even in administrations that seem to be incredibly threatened by federal regulation.
Well, it's very positive to hear. I like that. Maybe cars will remain safe with a new Department of Transportation secretary who has zero experience with transportation, but he was on a reality show, so that's always a plus in this administration. So the new DOT head comes in. Do they assign the head of NHTSA, or is that a separate nomination process?
They're part of the process, I'm sure. The process of consulting them for that. But ultimately, who knows really in this next administration how those decisions are made? But ultimately, I'm sure that the new DOT secretary will play a role in trying to figure out who's going to be the nominee for NHTSA's next administrator.
And what are the odds that Fred Perkins will be the nominee for the new administrator of NHTSA?
Well, there's no chance because I have solved differential equations in the past, and that is a disabling characteristic of any nominee that's going to be involved in engineering regulation.
Well, there you go. We'll put you down as neurodivergent.
Thank you.
No problem. Up next, Ford. Oh, poor Ford. Ford will have to pay a $165 million fine for failing to comply with federal recall requirements. So $165 million, like I would love to have that. But if I'm Ford, and what's their market cap? Billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. Is this much of a fine? Is this much of a disincentive?
Well, it's you say $165 million, and that's the consent order. But essentially, I think 65 million of that has to be paid within 60 calendar days of the order, and then there's another 55 million dollars, which is an abeyance amount. So NHTSA has set certain goals for Ford as part of this. They're going to have, an independent monitor that's evaluating how much better Ford is doing on recalls during the next few years. Ford is going to have to put in place a system for tracking parts and being able to track parts by VIN number. Apparently, I mean, this all started with a series of rear view camera recalls where apparently, it's not totally clear from the consent order or from the NHTSA investigation that's exactly what happened, but there was pretty significant violation to see a fine of this size. It appears that Ford was, was doing a recall on certain vehicles. Other vehicles that had that same technology installed weren't being recalled. And so ultimately, Ford had to do, a number of different recalls for this same part rather than just doing them all at once. Now, maybe that's why Ford is leading the recall charts every year, is because they're staggering out all these recalls. And that also provides an answer for a question we've had for a long time, which is why does Ford lead the pack in recalls every year? But additionally, it's a game that Ford and that other manufacturers have played for a long time with NHTSA, where they're aware of a failing part in a certain number of vehicles. They know that part or something very similar to it is in a lot of their other vehicles, but they try to focus the recall as small as possible to reduce their costs and essentially hiding the other vehicles from sight until, more consumer complaints come up or other reasons come up for that section of vehicles to be recalled. So it's kind of a shell game that's been played by a lot of manufacturers over the years, including Ford. And this is a great move by NHTSA to kind of put a cap on that. Ford is going to have to spend, I think I talked about the 65 million and the 55 million. There's another 45 million that's also going to be required to be spent by Ford, not as a fine, a civil penalty, but to improve their capacity to evaluate safety problems. They're going to have to spend $20 million on advanced safety data analytics. They're going to have to spend $10 million on another system that has like end-to-end information on vehicle compliance, and they're gonna have to spend another $10 million on a driver assist technology lab that focuses on low voltage electronics. I think that's because we've seen so many problems with electronic interference in these rear view camera systems that have been put out by Ford. And then they're gonna have to put out another $5 million to be able to trace their vehicle components by VIN, which goes to my idea that a lot of this problem was vehicle components that were unsafe, weren't being recalled in time. So Ford's got a lot to do, and we've talked on a number of occasions about their high recall numbers and their lack of quality assurance in the past, almost the past decade. They've just had a lot of problems there. Hopefully, some of this money that NHTSA is requiring them to spend will allow them to take control of that problem, but we shall see.
So this is amazing. I mean, this is, I think, the first time ever in this podcast where we're, roughly 20 minutes or so in, and two big thumbs up to NHTSA. Is that right?
That's right. NHTSA is busy. I mean, they've got a lot to get done before the administration comes in and replaces the people at the top of the building.
Yeah. So the new people at the top of the building, one of them is this guy Elon, who I don't know if he owns the building for all I can tell. He really wants to ease rules for self-driving cars because he showed, hey, I have this thing, and ignore the fact that it doesn't work. I'm gonna say it works, and people are gonna buy it, and this is gonna be great. And we're going to get into how the new administration may want to ease all these self-driving rules first. But I want to follow up something we talked about last week, which was when an AV breaks the law or violates some traffic safety thing. We had a question around, okay, who gets ticketed? Who gets issued this? And Michael did some work, looked up our friend Phil Copeman, and there's a law in California that says, hey, maybe there's a process in place to do this, but they actually haven't set up doing this. It's very confusing. Michael, can you understand? I'm in a self-driving taxi of the future, and it decides to run through a stop sign. Who gets the and the police pull it over and they go, hey, there's no driver. They're not going to give me a ticket as the passenger. So who's getting the ticket?
So, I mean, the vehicle and the company essentially would end up getting the ticket under the legislation that was passed in over the summer and approved in late September in California. Essentially, it allows, I mean, the bill authorizes peace officers or policemen to issue notices of autonomous vehicle non-compliance to the manufacturer of the vehicle upon observing a violation of the vehicle code. So how exactly this is going to take place is still a little bit up in the air because the bill authorizes the Department of Motor Vehicles to set these standards, how they're going to set just how this process is going to play out. Is it going to be a ticket you stick into the inside of the vehicle, it rolls down its window and you throw the ticket in? Is it going to be, a digital system where, the officer writes a ticket, but, there's really no one to give it to in the vehicle. And that goes into the system. It also, it requires that the manufacturers let the Department of Motor Vehicles know about the notice within 72 hours after it was issued. So it suggests that there are going to be actual tickets issued. But again, there's some latitude in the statute that allows the department to make these decisions final or modify the scheme at some point. But I think that the overarching point of all of this is that yes, police officers in California are going to be issuing tickets of some sort to autonomous vehicles when they break the law.
Well, the rules for implementation of a law always follow the passage of a law, right?
Well, yes, depending on how much time, I mean, the Department of Motor Vehicles is required to put these rules into place. That's what they've essentially been mandated to do by this bill. The time frame for that, as we know from NHTSA, it can be anywhere from a few months to many years, well over a decade. I expect, I'm not as familiar with how the Department of Motor Vehicles works in California and how fast they move on this type of thing, but I expect it will be in the next year or two when we'll see, and actual written regulations around how tickets are issued to autonomous vehicles.
Well, the really important part of this law is the requirement that AVs respond to geofencing in case of emergencies. So, if there's a fire, for example, the fire department or the police department can declare a zone around that fire where AVs need to be excluded. This will require some technology development, but I think it's a very important thing to do. And once it's developed in California, it could be implemented nationwide, I would think, very easily.
So let's repeat that one because Michael and I were talking about this one before the show started, and I find this fascinating. So I'm in an autonomous vehicle. It's in some sort of accident, it's caused some sort of road hazard, and now that vehicle or the police or who can, so who can set up that geofence to prevent other autonomous vehicles from coming in?
It doesn't, I mean, it could, I mean, it could happen in a situation like that that actually involves the autonomous vehicle, but this is more for a lot of the circumstances we saw in San Francisco where there would be a fire or an emergency call and the autonomous vehicles in the area got confused, caused a traffic jam, prevent emergency responders from reaching the destination they're trying to get to save lives. So essentially this would allow the emergency services to put a pin on the map and exclude autonomous vehicles from a certain zone when there's an emergency so that we don't encounter those kind of situations.
So overall, it includes accountability for AV behavior and also a requirement that they stay away from dangerous places that have been acknowledged. So I think, you know, this is a real advancement in AV regulation for the benefit of consumers and the public.
I love that. And I think we should add something like that into the Consumer Autonomous Vehicle Bill of Rights.
We should do that. I need to check it again.
All right. So related to this new administration coming in, Elon Musk, big part of it, saying, hey, I've got this self-driving robo-taxi nonsense and don't look over here and look over here and look at this demo. And he says it's going to get approved within months, blah, 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 blah. So right now, NHTSA, to get a autonomous vehicle on the road without pedals and steering wheels, you need an exemption from NHTSA, right?
Right.
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 So right now, NHTSA only offers like 25,000 of these per year. And
you can do 2,500.
Oh, sorry, 2,500.
It's a number that's not really palatable to folks who are manufacturing these because they want to be able to scale quickly to a lot more vehicles than that. Now, it's important to note that if you have an autonomous vehicle that is operating in a vehicle with a steering wheel and pedals, like Waymo is doing in most of its areas, then you can deploy as many as you want. There are no real rules around that. The only area where there are rules is if you're trying to put a vehicle out without traditional controls, which means you won't be able to meet current federal motor vehicle safety standards. So that would apply to folks like Zoox, which we've talked about recently. You know, they're claiming to have certified a vehicle to federal motor vehicle safety standards that doesn't have steering wheel or brake pedals. So there's still kind of an open question here of whether there really are any U.S. rules preventing the deployment of self-driving cars, or if, you know, if it's not really just up to the companies involved and their fear of liability when there's an inevitable problem with one of the vehicles and people are injured or killed. I think that most of these companies are more scared of the liability right now than they are the federal rules, which is why, you know, a lot of this chatter around, you know, Trump and Elon relaxing federal rules around self-driving cars kind of falls flat for me, because A, you know, there really aren't any rules preventing self-driving cars from being on the road. Most of the compliance that you're going to have to do as an autonomous vehicle manufacturer is going to have to be done at the state level. And all the states have, you know, somewhat different, but still fairly substantially similar autonomous vehicle regulations. Some states are a lot more permissive than others and require a lot less out of manufacturers. But there's going to be, you know, and some states have nothing at all. So I don't really understand the giant rules that have to be bent here for a manufacturer to introduce autonomous vehicles onto the road. There's not a lot standing in their way from that perspective. Also, you know, the fact that Musk and Tesla are pushing for these rules to be bent doesn't really make sense to me either, since, you know, Tesla doesn't have an autonomous vehicle. All of their vehicles require supervision. You know, they're based on a vision system that is totally inadequate on its own to power an autonomous vehicle in the future safely. They just don't have it yet. So the idea that, if you relax these rules now, I think you would be, you know, benefiting Tesla's potential future competitors in autonomy, which would be, you know, people like Zoox, who are trying to put a vehicle on the road without a steering wheel and pedals. You know, if you could ease rules, it would help them. It could help Waymo. But right now, Tesla doesn't really have an entry in the market. They just have, you know, another puffery claim by Elon that they're going to have this at some point in the future.
Michael, come on. So I'm going to bet a nickel, which is my betting limit, that we will very soon have a proposed federal law that updates the, by some people thinking oppressive regulations right now, that preempts all state requirements for safety certification of any AV. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And you know, right now, if people want to operate this way, they've got to have an exemption and they've got to live with the rules. And so it would be very simple for the Congress to just say, well, screw you. We're going to do whatever Elon wants. And what Elon wants is to eliminate all pertinent regulations and use the power of the federal government's preemption of state laws to say, eh, we're going to go nationwide with this.
Yeah, and that's something I think that we expect to be coming, but that's not going to be, you know, a Trump Elon administration decision. It's not an executive decision. It's going to require Congress to come in and create those create a law that does that. There's, you know, we've been pushing back on similar laws now for almost a decade. Very permissive laws that essentially allow manufacturers to deploy these vehicles anywhere and in very large numbers and prevent consumers from who are injured or killed by them from being able to sue the manufacturer when that happens. There's some really, really bad and consumer unfriendly laws that have been proposed over the past decade around autonomous vehicles. And I would expect that with the current congressional constitution or the current setup in Congress that we're going to be seeing bills like that come out very soon after the new year.
Well, you know what Elon doesn't want? He doesn't want you, listener, to go to autosafety.org and click on that donate button and put in so many zeros with a preceding number of your choice in front of it, because it's just a whole bunch of zeros. You're not donating anything. And Elon will be like, yeah, do that. And you don't want to make Elon happy. So go to autosafety.org, click on donate, and we'll keep pushing against Elon and these dangerous, dangerous laws that he wants to get out there. Because in his mind, even seatbelts are a step backwards. They repress my freedom to do my herky jerky dance when I listen to YMCA with Donald in my passenger seat. Because that's what I imagine the two of them just in a Tesla Roadster dancing, being like, yeah, YMCA, yeah. And then both of them thinking the other one's weirder than they are. But that's just
Yeah,
my
I think
thought process.
your southern accent with Elon is kind of weird, actually.
Well,
But
he's South African. There you go. Bro, bro, bro. I don't know how to do that. But anyway, so my gaslight of the week, we're jumping right into that. My gaslight of the week was for a second, it was teetering on Michael Brooks there, thinking that, hey, this isn't an act of Trump and Elon. This has to go through Congress, not realizing that Congress is just a bunch of toadies for Trump and Elon. Come on, this is a group of people without a spine being like, okay, yeah, Constitution bad. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, I mean, one of these clowns recently said, hey, we don't need a union anymore. Let's get rid of these blue states. Yeah. So, yeah, it was touch and go there, Michael. I'm not sure if it's you or I'm just going to go back to Cathie Wood, ARK Investment. I don't have to say anything else because that's just
Yeah,
all
you know,
impressive.
I thought it was important to make a distinction between, you know, executive action and legislative action there.
See, this is why people don't like you, educated people, you know, trying to tell me I'm wrong when I'm wrong. All right, Michael Brooks, who's your gaslight nominee of the week?
So my gaslight nomination of the week was and is the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, who, you know, essentially came out in opposition to a recently proposed pedestrian safety standard by NHTSA that focused on head injuries. Under the, you know, and they came out against it for an odd reason. You know, they said that because NHTSA has deviated from standards in place all around the world, this decision could require new vehicle designs and then divert resources from their safety research and development efforts and blah, blah, blah. I mean, the fact is that NHTSA had to propose a standard here that was different than other countries because Americans choose to drive vehicles that are freaking gigantic. They are bigger than other countries. And when we're talking about, you know, where on pedestrians the injury is occurring and trying to protect their head, then the size of the vehicle and how the vehicle is designed are critical considerations. And the standard that's in place in the EU simply wasn't going to be able to evaluate the giant trucks that the manufacturers themselves have been providing to consumers for over 30 years now as vehicles have grown larger and larger. So it's ultimately their own fault that they're in this situation. So criticizing NHTSA for having to create a standard to accommodate their giant vehicles is, you know, ultimately their responsibility, and it's not something that NHTSA could really avoid in this scenario. So the Alliance once again has gotten my Gaslight of the Week nomination. Mm-hmm.
I prefer people who don't get run over and have head injuries. Fred Perkins, who's your Gaslight of the Week?
Well, I'm going with the most valuable corporation in the world right now. Any of you know what that is?
The Catholic Church.
No.
Oh.
Michael, your guess?
That is NVIDIA.
That is NVIDIA. Yes, you're absolutely right. And I would have gone with NHTSA for establishing the voluntary safety self-assessment website, but I like NHTSA this week because of the other work they're doing. So I'm skipping through to NVIDIA. And NVIDIA's voluntary safety self-assessment starts by saying AI-defined vehicles are creating safer and more efficient transportation while providing occupants with customized in-cabin experiences, close quote. So there's absolutely no proof of that statement.
Tell listeners what NVIDIA is before we jump down that rabbit hole.
Sure, sorry about that. NVIDIA is a chip manufacturing company that makes something called a graphical processing unit. And that is a piece of hardware that's supported by software that allows people to very rapidly make floating point arithmetic calculations. Now, this is a key to all of the artificial intelligence, and it's basically the engine that lets all these artificial intelligence engines work, just because there's an awful lot of calculations involved in it.
Copy.
So that's what NVIDIA does, and they're trying to sell this to the entire AV industry. And so they're starting with that statement that that's what they do. But again, there's no proof offered. There's no data offered. And we'll post this on our website. But for a scholarly appraisal of AI vehicles' control shortfalls, specifically including identifying research gaps through self-driving car data analysis by Missy Cummings, they really establish in that scholarly report that there's no basis for saying that AI will ever provide a safe self-driving vehicle. So that's the background, completely contradicting the assertion made by NVIDIA. But NVIDIA goes on to say, in particular, automated and autonomous vehicles are poised to transform the transportation industry. They have the potential to dramatically reduce injuries and fatalities from collisions, alleviate traffic congestion, increase productivity, and provide mobility to those who are unable to drive. So you notice what they've done here. They've mixed these aspirational statements with present tense of saying that, you know, because we think this can happen in the future, that's what we can do. It's a very subtle rhetorical technique for confusing the public who's reading this. And you've got to be really perceptive to notice those verb tense changes and what's going on here. So it's, whether or not intentional, is certainly very misleading to anybody who's reading this. There are a lot of other points, but I'm only going to harp on two of them. So they tout the fact that NVIDIA uses TÜV SÜD, an independent accredited assessor, to ensure compliance with the International Organization for Standardization, ISO 26262, Functional Safety Standard for Road Vehicles. Period. close quote. Well, that's fine, except that ISO 26262 has no actionable definition of what safety is. Their definition of safety is the absence of unreasonable risk. That's like defining the atmosphere as the absence of a vacuum. It's not something. It's just a property that whatever that something is has got to also exhibit. So we have been advocating for an affirmative statement of safety, something like, acceptably safe disposition of the vehicle, which can be tested on a track, can be affirmatively included in design requirements. Absence of requirements, absence of data is not a design standard. It's just a void. So for NVIDIA to say that we're compliant with the standard, therefore we're safe, really requires you to look into the standard and discover that there's no there. There is no statement of what safety actually is. There's only a statement of one of the properties that safety might have to have. So you want to call that nonsense or not? I'm not sure, but I certainly think of it that way. And there's another key point in this. What they say is, in situations, quoting again, in situations where the vehicle is outside as defined ODD or conditions dynamically change to fall outside it, our products enable the vehicle to return to a minimal risk condition, paren, also known as a safe fallback state, close paren, end quote. Well, that's great, except that minimal risk condition needs a definition, which is not included in the statement. Also, the minimal risk condition is usually referred to SAE J3016, and SAE J3016 defines a minimal risk condition as something that is not safe. It's not a condition. It's a fallback state. And basically, it's unattainable because of the large numbers of variables involved in any assessment of comparative safety. So in both cases, NVIDIA refers, defaults to safety statements that are unachievable and unprovable. So I think that's probably enough for now. But I think you see why I think that NVIDIA's strategy of obfuscation enables it to be my nominee for Gaslight of the Week. Thank you.
Pretty good. I'd suggest to any manufacturers like NVIDIA or Zoox or GM Cruise or Tesla to avoid using the phrase minimal risk condition, because I'm pretty sure Fred Perkins has this set up as a news alert. And anytime any company uses it in a press release or in anything, he goes, aha, joy, I have my windmill to tilt at today. Ha ha.
Well, you flatter me, but I think I'm going to have to use AI to find out all those references, but that's another matter.
And that's another reason to donate to the Center for Auto Safety, because who else is going to look up, this is your reference, I'm going to dig deeper. Who else is going to, you're not going to do it, I'm not going to do it, but Fred Perkins and Michael Brooks will. So before we go into the town and listen to more of Fred Perkins' dulcet tones, let's talk about Tesla, because we've suspected this. I've suspected this. And now studies come out and show that people who drive Teslas are jackasses. That's right. Teslas are the most fatal cars on the road. There's a report from a group called IC Cars where they looked into all sorts of crash data going back years. And it's not that Teslas, the vehicles themselves, are necessarily dangerous. I mean, there was a family who drove off a cliff in San Francisco. All of them survived after a 200-foot drop. They do great in IIHS crash tests. It's that they're being sold by a lunatic who says, these cars drive themselves. You don't have to do anything you want. And so people buy them and go, yeah, Elon, you know what he's doing. Let's go. Woohoo. And they don't pay attention. They think the car drives itself and they kill people. Is that the summation?
Well, they die and they're also being burned alive after the crash. So, let's give a little detail on that.
On another okay, and so also this is a we'll link to from our friend of the show, Phil Copeman. He's talking about how more and more people are burning alive in Teslas, and this is horrific. And the Tesla fanboys basically say, yeah, that's your fault. How do you not know the secret way to escape the car? because when you get into a crash, the battery systems, the electrical systems that control opening and closing the doors, die. And so now your car's on fire and you have to remember, oh yeah, the secret handle to get out. I have to remove a speaker grill and reach in and pull this out. Whereas I don't know. I mean, imagine if I was in that situation, my entire thought process wouldn't be, where's the secret escape hatch? It would be, which is.
And tools are required. So you've just been in a crash, your car's on fire, and you can't get out. So you need to reach for your toolbox in order to get to this magic safety release. And by the way, if you're in the back seat, you're screwed because there's no safety, no manual safety release back there.
Wait, even for those doors, so the two times I've been in a Tesla that was in Uber, there's no manual release there? Like I can't, there's no secret door panel I have to decode?
That's what I've read. I don't own a Tesla myself, so I haven't been able to verify it, but that's what I've read.
Amazing. Michael, what was your take? Is this a legit study and report?
On the fire side, I mean, we have long been pointing out there's a real problem with Tesla vehicles and emergency escape, mainly because the manual releases are hidden for the doors and people don't know where they are. It's not, you know, it's not really something a lot of people think about when they're just purchasing a new vehicle. You know, let me look and figure out how I'm going to get out of this vehicle when it catches fire is not something that comes to mind and something that people are really prepared for. We think that emergency releases and manual emergency releases in electric vehicles should be standardized. Their location should be standardized, just like, you know, other safety systems in the car, so that you know where they are when seconds matter. You don't have time to open up your driver's manual and figure out how to remove a speaker cover or a panel in your door to access this manual release. It's a silly system. It's really bad human factors, human interface design, and I think it's going to be a problem if more vehicle manufacturers start including this type of thing wherever they want to put it. I think it needs to be standardized in a location where anyone driving a rental car, a car they're not used to driving, is going to be able to know where the manual release is when they're in a situation that requires quick action.
I'd like this as part of the dealer process. You go to buy a car and be like, oh, what kind of mileage does it get? How often do I have to rotate the air in my tires? So I'm in a catastrophic crash and the car's on fire. How do I open the doors? That would be a fun conversation to have with a dealer, right? Anyone? No? All right, let's go.
Not my kind of fun. I'm sorry.
Well, look, you want to hang out with the car dealership. You got to ask them some good questions. Okay.
It's hard to not be a little bit gloomy about this. The whole prospect of spending, $100,000 on a vehicle that's going to trap you and burn you alive. Not a great idea.
Well, you know, I'll cancel my order for my Cybertruck. I was feeling good about myself anyway. I don't really need that to extend my... Anyway,
there you go.
Let's go to the Tao of Fred, and this week's topic is renewable natural gas.
Renewable natural gas. Okay, so why does this matter? It matters because people are selling it, right? And so the question is, what is the rationale for this? If you look at the amount of natural gas that's being released, let me just talk about flare gas from refineries. Okay, and you've probably all seen this as you drive along the interstate in New Jersey or anywhere else that's got a refinery. There's a stack with flames coming out of it, and it's burning continuously. So, you know, the magnitude of this is astounding. If you look at the amount of flare gas that's burned, it is about 25% of the annual natural gas consumption in the United States. So,
wait,
tremendous.
Wait. What?
Tremendous amounts being burned, but you know, it's
insane.
It is insane, but it's a safety measure for the most part, because all the pipes from all these different refining stages, if you will, all end up in the same place. And so if they overpressurize, they vent through this particular stack and they keep the flame burning so that in the event of an overpressurization anywhere, that it goes out through the stack and gets burned up and keeps the refineries from exploding. So it's hard to know what to do about this.
Well, I kind of think my approach to do this is, hey, if we have an energy source where we have to burn off 25% of it, maybe we got to find a different energy source. But
yeah,
that's a different topic, I guess. Go on.
That's a different topic. But anyway, we're talking about natural gas. And one of the things that people are thinking of doing is modifying diesel engines so they can burn natural gas. And this will provide an additional market for that. The natural gas is primarily methane. Methane is a chemical that has one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms in it. All hydrocarbons are made up of carbon and hydrogen, hence the name. And methane is the simplest one. Why that's important is that biological processes that decay organic matter produce a lot of methane. So your farts, for example, have a lot of methane in them. That's why teenage boys like to light them on fire, because it's very... you've never done that? Okay, never mind. I see the look on your face.
Oh, no, it's hilarious.
Different kind of teenage experience then, I guess. But that actually works based on my experiments. And so there's a lot of methane being produced by biological processes. People talk about cows farting and sheep farting, but also dumps and farms that produce a lot of biological material or that contain a lot of biological material exude methane inevitably as part of the rotting of the organic matter that's in them. So green methane is collected from rotting organic materials like dumps, like farms and sewage pits and things like that. So that's what people talk about when they're talking about green methane what is the expression? So renewable methane, right? So they're talking about biological sources of methane. Chemically, it's the same essentially as the gas that comes out of wells, including fracking. Fracking is primarily oriented towards releasing methane gas from subterranean deposits. So the market for methane is enormous. The amount of that gets wasted is enormous. And what the biomethane introducing into the market is primarily, based on all of these numbers that I've been looking at, a advertising mechanism for saying that, this is really good stuff. But compared to the amount of gas that's being wasted in flare gassing and, other processes, it's hard to know that if one type of methane fuel is really better than the other. Is fracked gas better than biogas? I don't know. If you have a lot of biogas, I guess you don't need as much fracked gas. But again, these are enormous amounts of gas that's coming into the market from geological sources compared to the very small amounts that are coming in from biological sources. That's interesting. It may be renewable, but, again, you have to look into the source. Is it a dump where you're getting the gas, or is it a farm that's actually processing biological materials over and over again to maximize its own return on the investment in carbon that's inevitable when you're doing farming?
But the term renewable in my mind says you can use it more than once. Like I have glasses in my kitchen. They're renewable. Yeah. I use them all the time. That's reusable. But this is not renewable like that. It's not renewable in the nomenclature.
Well, it's not reusable. I mean, you can only burn the gas once, right?
Okay.
But you can essentially recover it by growing corn, for example, which takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, puts it back into cellulose, and then you can rot the cellulose and produce methane. So if you look at that globally, there is kind of a cycle that you can hypothesize. Is it actually working that way? I don't know. Michael, what?
I was going to say, it's renewable in the sense that traditional natural gas comes from underground and there's a limited supply there, whereas the biomethane can be doesn't require that. You know, there's not a fixed amount inside of the earth. You know, it's essentially up to how much of it we want to capture.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And also, you know, there's landfills and organic, you know, sewage systems and all this organic rot going on all around the world. A lot of that methane is just being released into the atmosphere. At least in this case, you would be capturing that methane to use as a fuel and also reduce the amount of methane released to the atmosphere. Those are probably the two benefits here, I would speculate.
That's true. That's absolutely right. But you also have to balance the amount of investment required to recover that methane versus the amount of methane release that's inevitable and natural. For example, if you look at the Gulf of Mexico, there are enormous amounts of hydrated methane that are in the soil or the sediment, if you will, underneath the Gulf of Mexico. And that melts and percolates up through the surface anyway. My uncle once lived in Erie, Pennsylvania, and he said nobody there had to pay for natural gas because all you needed to do was put a pipe into the ground and the methane came up all by itself and you could collect it and burn it in your house. So there's lots and lots of methane around. A problem is, how do you tell biogas from geological gas? Chemically, it's the same, right? And in both cases, you have to add mercaptan, which allows you to smell it. Methane itself has no odor. So you need to add something to the gas supply so that you can sell it and detect whether or not there's a leak. So lots of issues here. And if somebody sells you renewable biogas, well, that's great, but you're in a position where you need to give them absolute trust over their supply chain and wonder whether or not they've actually gotten this out of biological sources or whether or not they've just mixed in something from the local gas company. Anyway, that's a lot. Any more questions about that? What it means and what happens? By the way, if you convert a diesel engine to burn methane rather than to burn diesel fuel, it has a lot of benefits. It reduces the amount of soot, reduces the amount of nitrous oxide that's reduced. Basically, natural gas runs clean or burns lean so that there's no unburned hydrocarbon in the exhaust. That's why they use it in forklifts and enclosed spaces. But when you convert a diesel engine to burn natural gas, you basically convert it from being a diesel engine to just an internal combustion engine with spark ignition. So there's lots of issues there as well. Probably good in the long term, but you got to balance that investment in modifying the diesel engine against the value of burning the biodiesel the biogas or whatever is being represented to you as biogas. So it's complex. It's a complex situation. Overall, sure, burn biogas if and when you can, but let's make sure we don't lose the perspective that there are a lot of extraneous sources of gas. They need to be controlled as well in order for us to reduce the amount of methane that's actually going to the atmosphere.
Okay. I want to propose another tau on fuel-related things. Would be, what is it? I lost it out of my head. It's what F1's planning to move to in a couple of years, where it's completely clean fuel sources. So it's some sort of not synthetic gasoline, because it's not really gasoline, but it's all clean synthetic fuels.
All right. Well stop looking at your bird feeder and send it to me once you.
I don't have a bird feeder. I'm looking at your ugly faces. No, they're very pretty. And hey, with that, let's go to a recall. I'll try to recall that statement. Hyundai, 34,964 vehicles. This is the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe Hybrid. Inadvertent sunshade activation could increase the risk of minor pinch point injury occurring from unexpected closure of the fabric sunshade with an extremity in the enclosed fixed sunroof space. I know this could cause somebody to get pinched, but this is the most adorable recall I think we've ever come across, because, you know, you got your sunshade and this is a cloth one, so you're going to get a little pinch, or is this more serious and I'm a jackass?
Well, if it's not your fingers being pinched, I suppose you.
Yeah.
There you go.
And I think, you know, a lot of the motivation, you know, this is a non-compliance with Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard 118, which controls the safe operation of power windows and sunroofs. And that standard was put into place for, a not so nice reason, which was, you know, children were getting their heads and necks caught in power windows that were opening and strangulating them. And, you know, a number of children were dying every year through inadvertent activation of power windows. And so the agency put into play 18 FMVSS 118 that essentially prevents those injuries from happening. It does it in a couple of ways. It's making sure that the buttons that control power windows are recessed in a way that doesn't allow for inadvertent activation. That's the problem in this recall. The button's not fully recessed, so the panel can move without the driver or the occupants intending it to move, and trap fingers, most likely children's fingers, which is really what the standard was geared towards, to prevent children from getting into bad situations when they're exploring the interior of mom's vehicle. So that's why this standard exists. And, you know, it applies to basically any window or sunroof or any other moving partition, not to doors, but to window type partitions in the vehicle. They're going to have to be able to do things like not have controls that are easily accessed by children. There's a provision that can require windows to reverse automatically when they encounter an obstruction, like a finger and a pinch point. And so that's a good standard to have, even though in this situation it seems a little cute. It's the standard is there for very important reasons.
All right, let's move on to the next one. General Motors 77,824 vehicles, the 2022 to 2023 Chevrolet Express, the GMC Savannah, and this is a transmission control module. The rear wheels lock up momentarily while driving, or the vehicle moves in an unintended direction at low speeds. Uh-oh. This isn't good. Not cute.
Yeah. This one's pretty easy. You know, if you've got a defect that allows the vehicle to go in forward when the driver thinks it's in reverse, or the opposite, that's a bad thing and can pretty easily result in injuries, or, you know, probably a lot of damaged garages. In this case, this recall is for the GM and Chevy large kind of cargo vans. And owners should hear about that one just in time for Christmas.
Oh boy. Last recall, Ford. Ha! What are they doing here? 27,678 vehicles, the 2020 to 2025 Ford Explorer, Lincoln Aviator, Ford Escape, Lincoln Corsair, F-150, Ford Expedition, 2018 to 2024 Lincoln Navigator. And it looks like the dashboard airbag warning label was not installed on vehicles exported to U.S. territories. That's it. They're missing a sticker.
Yeah, they're essentially missing the dashboard airbag warning label that, you know, tells you things like, you know, don't put a child in front of this, or, you know, a small female, make, you know, be aware that there is an airbag here and that it could deploy and injure you if you're not in the appropriate position. So that's going to be a label that I think is just going to be sent out by mail to owners. And if you are an owner of these vehicles and you don't get a label, you should be able to request one from your dealer.
Yeah, it's listed as just a hang tag. Huh. Anyway.
Was that included in the massive Ford penalty we talked about earlier?
I don't know if this was. You know, NHTSA in the last week has opened up two additional recall queries around Ford. And they didn't really note in those whether or not they were related to the penalty. But it looks like, as part of their investigation into Ford's recall practices, they uncovered a couple of other things that they want to look into. So Ford is still somewhat under investigation for some bad recall practices by NHTSA. And, you know, those investigations are new. We'll have to see how they progress and see how interested the new administration is in pursuing enforcement matters.
And with that, listeners, thanks for spending time with us. We appreciate it. Tell all your friends, donate, give us 5 stars. And until next time, stay sane.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.